Dublin. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublin. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello, could I please speak with Paul Muldoon?
You're speaking to Paul Muldoon. How are you?
I am very well, and Paul, I am delighted that you are part of the Quarantine Tapes co-presented by Dublab and the Onassis Foundation here in LA. It is really good to talk to you. It's been much too long, really much too long. And Paul, tell me, how have you been living these last 11 delirious months we have been going through?
Well, most of that time I have spent in central New York, in a small village called Sharon Springs, about 45 minutes west of Albany. And I've had a house here for a few years and in many ways never quite understood why I had that house.
Until
almost exactly a year ago, in the same week a year ago when everything was going reasonably smoothly in New York. I'd actually just made a trip to Ireland in the first weekend of March, and then I'd done a show at the Irish Arts Centre, a show called Muldoon's Picnic, with a couple of great guests, and Enright Steve Earle, who has been on your show.
Yes.
And then the Tuesday night, I went for a post-show conversation at the Irish Repertory Theater. Do you detect an Irish theme here, Paul?
I somehow do. How could that
be? I have no idea.
We'll get to that.
In any case, I had the great privilege of having a show based on one of my poems called Incantata, an elegy for a wonderful printmaker with whom I used to live, Mary Bowers. Was her name, who died much too young. And anyway, there was a theatrical representation of this longer poem. So it was cut short by the pandemic. And I think Wednesday or Thursday of this week, a year ago, we came up to central New York and have stayed here pretty much for the duration.
I came across this quotation from Roland Barthes from a text of his called Leçon, Lesson. And he says in it, "There's an age when we teach what we know, but then there comes another, when we teach what we do not know. That is called seeking. Perhaps now comes the age of another experience, that of unlearning." And I'm wondering how that resonates with you, Paul. I somehow have a feeling that it could vibrate with your sensibility.
Well, it does vibrate with me. It certainly resonates with me because I am committed to the idea, first of all, of teaching. And even though I teach at Princeton University, a university with which you have some familiarity yourself.
I do.
And it often, I think, strikes my students as being a bit odd, particularly when they've gone to so much time and trouble and perhaps money in some cases to get into Princeton based on what they know. I really foreground the idea of unknowing. And so I try to nurture in my students a sense that to be able to write interesting poems, and indeed I think to make art of any interest at all, or perhaps even to write a paper of any interest, and, you know, a so-called academic paper, that actually one must give oneself over to the notion of a profound innocence, ignorance indeed. This is not to say that one leaves one's brain outside the room. It certainly does not mean that, because I think really to be able to write a poem, one needs more brain power than most of us, certainly myself, are able to muster. However, the bit that is generally not so honored so valorized is ignorance, unknowing, innocence. And that's what I try to teach my students, and that's what I try to remember myself anytime I sit down to try to write something. I write in the absolute conviction that I have no idea what I'm doing.
How does one get there, though? You know, I always remember that wonderful line of Kierkegaard where he said that the goal is to arrive at immediacy after reflection.
Yes, well, I think there are ways of achieving it. And one way that I sometimes use, I try different things. Exercise, if we may call it that, that I often assign my students is some version of exquisite corpse.
Right.
An idea often associated with the visual arts, where one is a head from the Mona Lisa and a torso from some Greek bust, and the legs from whatever, a centaur. This involves beginning with a line. Often I take it from the day's paper, and I put it down there, and the first student responds to it by adding a line, then it obscures the very first line, passes it to the next. They respond to that line. And by the time we've finished, there's very clear evidence that the poem was not actually written by anyone in the room. It's a fabulous way of presenting the notion that actually the poem is, at its best, writing itself, responding to where it might be taking itself, responding to the line immediately before it. And of course, in many ways, it can't possibly follow what we would usually think of as a logical course. However, there are properties somehow in the language that amalgamate ideas that come together. I'm a great believer myself, however old-fashioned it might seem, in the collective unconscious, the Jungian notion. So anyway, I do that. I often assign them a text called Zen and the Art of Archery by the great German philosopher, Herigel, which is a fabulous text.
And has the extraordinary virtue of concision.
It does, which is always a good thing, and I think it's why many of us went into the poetry business in the first place. And I do suggest to my students that they could probably read it in an hour or maybe less. And of course, Herigel goes off to Japan to study with a master archer, and is astonished to again and again is reminded that the master is able to hit the bullseye in pitch darkness, blindfold. How on earth can he do that? And of course, he learns that it's only when he gives himself over to the idea that, to quote from the book, it shoots, it hits. Only then is there any chance of bullseye being scored. And of course, vis-a-vis the poem, we don't necessarily know that it is a bullseye that's being scored. But one thing we do know is that if I know what's happening in a poem, the chances are that everyone else is going to know that too. So I try to bring myself and my students to a place where they really did not expect to be. None of us expected to be. So that's the principle.
Now, John Cage said to the painter Philip Guston, when you start working, everybody is in your studio. The past, your friends, enemies, the art world, and above all, your own ideas. All are there. But as you continue painting, they start leaving one by one, and you are left completely alone. Then, if you're lucky, even you leave. Is that what you have in mind?
Well, that, I think, some version of that. And of course, there's no decent analogy or metaphor, I think, to cover, what is continues to be a somewhat mysterious business. I do certainly believe that if one's lucky, there are lots of people in the room. You know, most of us start out as writers, for example, by copying writers whom we like. In my case, it was the preeminent one was T.S. Eliot when I was a teenager. And, you know, after a while, they sort of you have to banish them in some ways, actually, however important they were at the outset. And again, one's own ideas, I think, actually, one has to banish also. The minute one begins to sound like what someone might describe as oneself, one has to go immediately in an opposite direction. In other words, there are various cherished ideas about writing that I think are problematic. We've already touched on one, write about what you know. After that, you know, one is constantly addressing what one doesn't know.
It's so interesting because I think I heard you speak in one form or another about the question of lineage. You mentioned T.S. Eliot, and I know also how important Yeats was for you. And I ask that question to Sonny Rollins, the great jazz saxophonist.
Yeah.
I said to him, tell me, would it make any sense, Sonny? I mean, he met Coleman Hawkins when he was 7. I said, would it make any sense to say that Coleman Hawkins, whose playing is so different, of course, from Sonny Rollins, but who at the same time was so important to giving the sound of the saxophone to jazz. I said, would it make any sense to say that you were influenced by him? And Sonny said, I hope so.
Well, that's right.
Who would it be for you? Who would I hope so be for you?
Well, the main influences on me, I mean, one is I'm reading all the time and I hope learning all the time. To go back to what we were saying a moment ago, I mean, every time I go into a bookstore and see a book called How to Write a Poem, I immediately buy it because there's always something there, several things.
You're still trying to figure out how to write a poem, right?
Well, you know, I mean, in a profound sense, of course, one never never achieves that, which, you know, might seem to call into question the idea of whether or not if one can never learn to write one, how could one possibly ever teach oneself or anyone else to write one? That's for another conversation, perhaps. But one always discovers something that may be useful, you know, when one is next faced by the blank page. So, yes, I mean, the influences for me were the big ones when I was a kid. Eliot, I mentioned, and by extension, someone whom Eliot, to a large extent, reinvented was John Donne, the great metaphysical poet. And Donne is probably the single most important poet for me then and now, though there are many others, of course. But I often ask myself, particularly in this age of when we have these pictures, for example, of the latest foray on Mars, I think to myself, what would Donne be making of this? What are the images? What are the similes, the metaphors that he would be coming up with for this? So there's a kind of brilliant innocence. I go back to that word about Donne, that one is constantly trying to keep into the foreground in one's own mind.
Is there a poem in particular of Donne that you've loved and come back to again and again and again?
You know, the single most important poem for me, there are many, but the single one is The Flea, in which he manages to suggest, more than at least, very strongly suggesting to his beloved or hoped for beloved, that just as the flea in their bed has sucked her blood and his, and therefore to all intents and purposes represents a wedding ceremony, there's a kind of sacramental aspect to what has just happened. She's about to crush the flea to purple her nail, maybe it is, in blood of innocence. And I says, don't do that, for heaven's sake, because you will be killing both of us. You'll be committing murder. You'll be committing blasphemy, and so on and so forth. So this completely outrageous argument made by the speaker of the poem is just spellbinding, really. And so it's for that reason, I suppose, that I would think of Donne initially. Funnily enough, Donne came to mind quite recently for me when I during the our present predicament.
Tell me.
Well, Donne, one of his most famous poems actually is a crown of sonnets, or a corona of sonnets. And I actually found myself just under a year ago wondering about, you know, a day-to-day, a journalistic response to what was happening around us, just at the very beginning of April of 2020. And I started writing a poem which it turns out to be a corona of sonnets, or a crown of sonnets, or a double crown of sonnets. It's a very interesting format. It's, in this case, it's 15 sonnets. The last line of sonnet one bleeds into the first line of sonnet two, and same at the end of sonnet two and into sonnet three. It sounds quite contrived and quite tortuous and probably slightly mad, actually. Sonnet 15 is entirely made up of those first slash last lines of the preceding 14 sonnets, and as a standalone feature. So it is a little bit of a trial, I suppose, of craft, you know. I'm a big believer, not only in the unknowing that we were describing earlier on, but actually I believe, I suppose, that poets actually may learn some version of a craft. That was a very major component in Irish culture, for example. There were poetry schools in the, let's say, the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries in Ireland. And beyond that, people did go to learn how to write a poem. So I do think that in addition to honoring ignorance and innocence, as I've described, one actually might also honor having some sense of a craft. Anyway, this is a poem set in Sharon Springs, as I mentioned earlier, and it begins like this. At the end of our driveway, the yellow recycling bin will be picked up this morning by Vlad, our superintendent of public works. I certainly don't want to impugn the motives of the village elders, who, after the big flood washed it out, closed our road to through traffic. That's proved to be largely a godsend. It's now only once or twice a day an Orphic figure passes, glancing back for whatever has his scent, and will, somewhat soonish, tear him limb from limb. Were it open, the picture house in Cobleskill would be showing a shoot-em-up or creature feature. For 3 weeks now, Jean and I have been on the lam in Sharon Springs, a couple of old-school bank robbers lying low for the foreseeable future. So that's how it begins. Obviously, it's a sonnet that uses the language of our everyday speech in 2020, this was, but also follows a very, a very specific rhyme pattern, often using half rhymes.
Yes.
Flad and flood, godsend and scent, Cobleskill, old school. No particular brownie points for engaging with rhyme. It just happens that many of my poems do.
Might you read the last 15th?
Read what? 15?
Yeah.
Sure, let me just get that in front of me. 15. Yes, 15 is the, in this case, is, oh, in case you want to edit this, let me just give you it. Sonnet 15, in this case, is made up of the first slash last lines of the previous 14 sonnets. At the end of our driveway, a standard yellow recycling bin brings back the idea of a future to which we once subscribed. Even as I pine for a past in which the use of straw for cattle fodder was a topic of interest to the serious mind, it's a past in which one constant is some form of pestilence. At present, all I can think of is the burial mound, once known as Plaguey Hill, that dominates Friars Bush Graveyard in Belfast. The yellow of that bin is more the yellow of bog asphodel than the yellow of forsythia or furze. In New York City, they've worked hand over fist to set up a system of field hospitals. Now there's been a flattening of the death toll from the novel coronavirus.
Goodness. I mean, it's so strong. I'm so glad you sent it to me in advance. And it speaks to our moment, and it was written before or during the very beginning of our moment.
Well, you know, one's always slightly worried about that, Paul. I mean, there's always a question of when is the right moment, if ever indeed there is a right moment. But maybe the right thing to do is just to do nothing and go to bed for a couple of years. But I think, you know, if one is semi-sentient at all, I don't know if one's obliged. I think perhaps I might go so far as to say obliged. Some days I would go so far as that. But certainly I find myself trying to make sense of my life. That's the phrase I use again and again of this particular activity. There are all sorts of ways of doing it. One can do it as a frontline worker. One can do it as the wonderful person in our village who picks up that recycling bin every week. One may do it in any number of ways, as a philosopher, a physician, trying to make sense of things. So I don't know if one necessarily achieves a final statement. In fact, I'm sure one doesn't.
Yes, to come back to our beginning.
Yes, well, there is a provisional aspect to all of this. It's a fascinating thing, when one is up to the moment, you know, super trendy. I mean, there's nothing so passé as what was trendy 50 years ago, 40 years ago, even 10 years ago, or maybe even a year ago. Things change so quickly. I mean, a year ago, I thought I knew, I had a vague idea of what the word Zoom meant. but now I think it means something. You know, one meaning has certainly changed. So, the trick would be to write something that's true to its moment, but that might resonate beyond its moment. I mean, that is if one believes in the future, that's an idea I touch on in that section of the poem. The future to which we might have appealed is problematical at the moment and somewhat precarious, I think. So that's sometimes a question. It's a question, I suppose, you know, in 10 years' time, will anyone be interested in reading this poem? And maybe not, or there'll be something else to read in 10 years' time, you know?
You know, you said to me in an exchange we had that you're interested in the normality rather than the abnormality of the pandemic. And that caught my eye very strongly. We have spoken so much in the past year of how unprecedented this was, but really not.
Well, you know, one certainly would not want to diminish the terrible, terrible, terrible toll this pandemic has wreaked worldwide and and actually horrifyingly in this country. I mean, in disproportionately in the United States. But it would be a short-sighted to think that the world has never seen anything like this. I mean, we know, I mean, even 100 years ago, speaking of futures and pasts, I mean, we do know that in 1918 there was a calamitous pandemic. We know that in this country that in the 1830s, in fact, worldwide, pandemic, absolutely a pandemic, cholera, which wreaked terrible havoc in that era. I mean, when I was doing a bit of research, as I found myself doing when I was writing this poem, Plaguey Hill, from which I've been quoting, you know, I realized that the annals of Ireland and their records, they're sometimes just a line for a year, you know, 777, whatever it might have been, the plague. So I think it would be short-sighted of us to imagine that, particularly since we settled down and started living in close proximity with, chickens and pigs, for example, you know, and some of us enjoyed and still do bacon and eggs. The minute you go down the bacon and eggs route, you're signing on for trouble, because there's going to be a leap. There's going to be an interspecies leap at any moment. So, I don't want to sound, you know, possibly resigned to this, but I think actually we'd be much better if we just did resign ourselves to the fact that this is part of what it is to be here in the world. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's taken a terrific toll on so many thousands of people in this country, and one does not want to diminish that. But I'm afraid that this is part of the deal.
What a pleasure it's been to talk to you. I have so many more things I would like to address. Maybe I can quickly ask you about what's coming next, because it's something so big. You're in the middle of working with Paul McCartney on a huge autobiography through songs.
Yeah, I mean, it's a book called The Lyrics. It's coming out in November. It was announced just the other day, and it's based on 154 songs from over the years, and with his commentary on them. So that's basically what it is. It's very exciting. It's going to be a big book, I think, obviously. And so, you know, I plug away at this and that. For better or worse, as a writer, I mean, I get up usually at 5 a.m. and start working, winter, summer. And in that sense, actually, and again, one doesn't want to seem crass in saying this, but in that sense, it's not business as usual, but being isolated, being shut away, is pretty much par for the course for me, and I think for many scribblers. You know, so in many ways, the kind of the pattern of my day-to-day life has not changed all that much. Again, one doesn't want to sound crass, but I'm just being honest about it.
Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. It's really been wonderful.
It's a pleasure, Paul. It's so great to connect with you again, and thank you so much for having me on your program.
Thank you so much. Take good care of yourself, and I hope when this pandemic is over, when this storm comes to an end, at least for a while, we get to see each other.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.